No.
Okay, great.
Nothing fancy. So
Go right to
that's
it
just,
then.
why don't you start out? I'm interested in knowing how you met Brian Forrester.
Oh, okay. Well, that does involve, also a connection to my teacher, so who, of course, we're going to talk about, Hakim.
Yes.
But there was a series of videos came out in around 2009 called The Pyramid Code. I don't know if you've heard of those or seen those.
No, I may have. I can't remember. I don't know that I have.
Okay, well, they were put out by a lady from Canada named Carmen Bulter. She's a professor of education.
Okay,
I
yes.
actually met her in Egypt in 1997 and introduced her to my teacher, Hakim. So to make a long story short, she then came to Egypt and then arranged for a professional film crew to come in from LA, and they did videos with him, interviews with him, that eventually became part of a series she produced called The Pyramid Code. So Brian had seen some of these videos and became very interested in my teacher, Hakim. And then he saw it connected through Googling and whatever, found my name on the web, and then contacted me. We connected through Facebook, and eventually I arranged for him to be part of a tour to Egypt with us in 2013. And we've now done 5 years in a row of what we call techno-spiritual tours to Egypt. So then through that connection, he came back 2014, 2015. He arranged for me and people I'm going to mention, Yusuf and Patricia Awiyan, part of the Kemet School of Ancient Mysticism, to come to Peru, because Brian leads tours to Peru and to Bolivia. Now he's also leading tours to Mexico. So we did a tour with him in 2015. It was very 24 2015. It was very successful. And then we 2014, excuse me. And then we came back again last year, 2016, and did another tour with him. So I've been working with him now for about 5 years.
Did you call the trips to Egypt techno-spiritual?
Yes, because we do both sides, and that's how my teacher Hakim taught through both sides of the brain, and what we produce the idea that the ancient people did not separate the spiritual and the technical. It was all part of one understanding to them. So,
Well, give me an idea of the spiritual side, because I've seen you guys talk about the machining and the giant megalithic,
yes.
Stones and the hardness of the stones and all that, but let's get into the spiritual a little bit.
Well, the spiritual, it seemed that it's actually my second book deals with that a lot. It's the idea that I make a separation in my second book because what we call spirituality and religion. Academia doesn't. Academia basically thinks we're hardwired for religion, and as soon as human beings began to think, they developed religion. Well, I disagree with that, and I've disagreed with that for many years, and so did my teacher. But spirituality is a different thing. It's just like coming to an understanding that there's more than the physical, that there's an essence that you can call spirit that's not created, not destroyed, that's within all things, and that continues on. So the idea is that the ancient people did not separate, so they understood that everything was a spiritual act. And so that we teach that how these things were built, like the pyramids, were the use of water and sound in particular. So sound was sacred. Sound was used in many, many different ways. Again, technically, we believe sound was used to create anti-gravity fields. That's how they could lift this incredible megatonnage. As my teacher Hakim used to say, the only way to deal with all that weight is to deal with the gravity. But sound also had a spiritual essence, which of course we still continue today through music, through sound that we use to develop spiritual. There's what you call now, since the 80s actually, or the 70s, New Age music, which specializes in trying to raise consciousness through music. But all music does that, all sound can do that. And so these ancient peoples use sound to actually increase the working of our immune systems. So that we talk about, people look at the Old Testament of the Bible, and you see that there's ages of the patriarchs in the Bible where they lived hundreds of years. And everybody just assumes that was just great mythology just added to be the veneration of these great ancestors. But in actuality, I believe that we actually did live longer time and age that we do now. And the basis of that is one of the foundation teachings of what we teach, which is called Kemetology, as opposed to Egyptology, and that's cycles. That we first thing, one of the things when I always begin talking on the subject, when we begin lecturing on the subject, is to say we throw out one principle right from the beginning, and that's the idea of linear Darwinian evolution. We don't throw out Darwin and evolution completely, but we throw out the idea of linear evolution, that we've only gone from the primitive to the complex in a straight line, and therefore we today, Homo sapiens sapiens in the 21st century AD, are the greatest thing that's ever been on the planet. And that's not what nature teaches us. Nature shows us everything moves in cycles. Everything in natural law moves in cycles. And one of the basic foundations of our teachings from Hakim is that we've gone through cycles. We go through what we call five stages, and we cycle these stages over and over, and that we go through one period, which we are in the highest stage of consciousness, and in the next period, we're in a state of darkness. So then when I used to always give my lectures on this subject, and always in interview, I say, well, what stage do you think we're in now? Now, when I first started doing this 25 years ago or more, people would say, oh, we're in the most enlightened stage. No, wrong. Thanks for playing. But now, through the years coming to audiences that are more in a higher state, understanding, they usually understand that we're in the lowest state in the cycle, the last 5,000 years or so, which is characterized by patriarchal religions, i.e. Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and state-sponsored institutionalized warfare and separation between us and them, things like that. That's what this cycle is characterized by polarity, by duality. So there's Jew, Christian, black, white, labels that separate. There was a time when we didn't adhere to those ideas, and we all saw each other as one consciousness. I mean, the ideal that all the teachers come along, or that Jesus taught, that Moses taught, that Muhammad taught, that what religions are based upon is certain beings who've come around and saying that we're all God's children, we're all the same, we're all together, and then they're usually crucified or killed, and a religion is created around them. So, but we did. So we're in the lowest stage of consciousness right now. But we're coming out of that. And that's the whole idea for my teacher, Hakim, releasing these teachings through masters who taught through him, through long lineages of traditions, of oral tradition, of himself being an incredibly unique human being who was an incredible scholar and went and just put all things together and saw that there was a previous civilization to what we think of as dynastic Egypt, and that pyramids were not tombs for anyone, and that the Sphinx is much, much older than anyone in academia would dare admit, except for one geologist at Boston University, the great Dr. Robert Schock.
So there was probably a more advanced man on the earth in the ancient past, is what you're saying.
Advanced is using more of our capabilities. So actually bigger brains too. This is what, again, you talk about Brian Foster, and I imagine you brought him up because you probably have interviewed him.
Yes.
The whole idea of the elongated skull people is fascinating, because my background is actually as an academic. I was pre-med, so I have a background in physiology and anatomy. I did not want to go on to become a physician, but I was interested at one time in medical research, then switched it all over to archaeology, which is my main love. But I have that background, and I recognize immediately when Brian started introducing these skulls for me of the so-called Paracas people, that we're talking about not head binding, not head shaping, not what native people have done the last 5,000 years, certain indigenous groups, to imitate these type of people. They had bigger brains.
Yeah.
We normally have a capacity average around 1,600 cubic centimeters of brain in our skulls today, the average modern human. These people went 1,800 to 2,400 cc's. So not only were they perhaps giants, 7 feet tall, that's quite possible, and we have evidence of Egypt of giants, quite possible, 15 feet tall people.
Right.
But they had much larger brain capacity. So here we go again, and as this subject has been broached, I just mentioned it to someone the other day, that we just in the last 20 years have discovered four new subspecies of Homo, of human. One of them fascinates me. It's called Baskop Man, and people can Google it, and it's usually spelled B-O-S-K-O-P. It found somewhere in Indonesia, I believe, a whole series of skulls and full skeletons of humans living 500, half a million years ago that had much bigger brains than we do today.
Wow.
So, what does that mean?
That's incredible.
And it doesn't necessarily mean aliens. We can broach that subject, as I messaged you as we were discussed, because I fall in between camps in that. That's why people have not seen me on Ancient Aliens, the show that I've turned down four times.
Oh, you've turned them down?
four times. First season, second season, fourth season, and the ninth season.
Oh, my goodness. I think you could
only because I believe they trivialized the subject. And a lot of the people who are on there, I honestly consider pseudo-researchers. Now, I do not like to, you know, come on here on a public forum and start to put down other people's research. Sure. People can believe what they want to believe in that. But a lot of that material, again, I'm a pioneer in the research. I was influenced in this subject in the 50s when I was a young kid, seeing the original The Day the Earth Stood Still. It seemed like it was real to me, not science fiction. So I've always been someone who's been in the subject area. In fact, I was involved in the 80s and 90s in interviewing many people who we did not call abductees. We called them contactees,
right,
or experiencers, and people who generally believed what they were experiencing. And I've seen things in the sky myself, which were not normal aircraft, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm not somebody who totally poo-poos the subject. But unfortunately today, a lot of things get passed off. And again, it comes back to my teacher, Hakim. I once brought him to the International UFO Congress in Laughlin, Nevada, put on by some great people, Bob and Teresa Brown. She has passed away. Great conferences that were in the summertime. And he spoke there. And people wanted to ask him about aliens, aliens, aliens. And he didn't want to discuss the subject because he would say it's to insult our ancestors, to say, oh, we're not capable of carving the Sphinx or building pyramids or at Baalbek or at Göbekli Tepe or wherever site you want to mention in the world where there are amazing things that cannot be explained by academic science, by Egyptologists or archaeologists with their normal paradigms. But doesn't necessarily mean it has to be aliens, and we couldn't do that. And this is where I am, because I am a student of prehistory for over 50 years. This has been my main subject, my main interest. And I've studied ancient civilizations all around the planet. And it is an insult to say that our ancient ancestors were not capable of doing these things we see. And I also believe in contact. So that's why I am in the middle of the camps. But I turned down Ancient Aliens, even though David Hatchett Childress is my publisher, because I believe they trivialize the subject. And this is why certain people like Christopher Dunn, who's a great colleague of mine, will not appear on the show anymore. Neither really will Brian Foster, because it goes on and on. How many times can you say that, you know, Thomas Jefferson spoke to aliens, or, I mean, everything that exists has to be because of aliens, you know.
Right.
It's become a catchphrase now.
Yeah.
You know? Not saying it's aliens, but it's aliens, you know.
I
don't really like to discuss the subject. I want to discuss the ancient Kemetians, who were people who lived over 10,000 years ago, who were in this highest state of consciousness, who I talked about, who built the pyramids and built the Sphinx even years and years before that. That dates that we put on it, nobody can venture to go to except certain few people. Like I say, now we have geological markers. With the Sphinx, we're on solid ground because geologists have come in. And that's to the blessings of someone who's ill right now. And we send out the best of health to John Anthony West, if you know who he is.
Oh, yeah.
He's a pioneer in this alternative research. He's been ill lately. But he was, to the gracious of him, brought in the great Robert Schacht to Egypt. And other geologists have come forth. And we can date the Sphinx geologically, that it's at least 30,000 years old.
30,000.
Because there's an event in paleoclimatology, which is called the Mousterian subpluvial. People can Google it. It occurs around, you know, these are always estimates, 30,000 years ago. There was severe rainfall in North Africa and in Southern Europe and in that area of the world. The erosion on the body of the Sphinx, water erosion, can only be caused by rainfall beating down for thousands of years. This is the credit of Dr. Robert Schacht, who did detailed analysis of the erosion. And so this has to be at least 30,000 years. Hakim said to us that the Sphinx was 54,000 years old.
I believe it.
And he would say then, someone proved me wrong. And geology only proves him right.
I have no problem with that at all.
It was the first thing carved above ground. What we show people is incredible understanding that there are things that are in layers. We have to talk about what's underground before what's above ground, because you get an incredible understanding of hydraulic engineering, of people who drilled straight through limestone bedrock to bring water from maybe 50, maybe even 100 miles away to the current Nile Valley, so that they built the pyramids, and the energy for the pyramids was basically water.
Now, in your book, The Land of Osiris, you say that the Sphinx is the guardian of all Egyptian mysteries. Why did you choose the word guardian?
Well, it becomes then the first of the first, the Alpha and the Omega. As Hakim would tell this wonderful story, as comes down in the mythology, She, and we say she, again, Egyptology says he. She says it's an image of a male king. We don't say pharaoh, because no one has used the word pharaoh correctly, including myself. There were no male pharaohs, period, end of discussion. But we'll go for the argument, for the point of discussion, we'll say king. They say the Sphinx represents a male king giving an offering to the sun. Wrong, absolutely. We can talk about it on two levels, as the face is today, but as she is according to tradition, she. According to tradition, now the basic understanding we also have, and I came to this understanding doing a second master's degree at San Jose State University for the Women's Studies Department, the actual degrees in social sciences, and in Egyptology, where I was arguing in 1975 that ancient Egypt was a matriarchy, not a patriarchy, not kings and sons. It went from mother to daughter. This is 15 years before I met Hakim. I meet him, and he reinforces that completely. According to his 75 years of research in the field, he was convinced that it was a matriarchy. So we're talking about a civilization where descent went from mother to son. Women were not only equal, but were superior to the male. So their image, their first image, is a goddess symbol of understanding of female creation. So they talk about Nut, spelled N-U-T. Sometimes when you know somebody doesn't know what they're talking about, they're lecturing and they say nut. No, Nut. The U is always ooh in the ancient languages. She was the great mother. She controlled all that was created and all that was uncreated, almost like Kali a little bit in the Hindu understanding. But even more so, she encompassed all. So the story comes down. When Nut wanted to manifest physically upon our planet, she spit. And where she spit landed is the Sphinx today. And she's called Tefnut. Teft means spittle, means moisture, means humidity, many different translations. But actually in this translation, the spit of Nut. Now why? Why? Only Hakim could answer that. And so we use the scientific term. When we expectorate, when we spit, it's never the same, and there's no mass, there's no volume. So basically the ancient people with this understanding were saying, you cannot define the Great Mother, but if you must, we'll build a statue here. And so that's it. She spit. Spit cannot be defined. There she is. That became the Sphinx. Hakim would tell us that all that is there today that is original for there is what would be the head of the Sphinx today. It is what's called in geology a yardang. It's just a natural limestone outcropping. Hakim said even before they came to the idea to create an image, people would come to that site to, as he would say, energize themselves 56,000 years ago, knowing then having the consciousness to seek points in the earth, which we call power places today, which we call vortexes, which we call intersection of ley lines. We know all about this today of our planet is actually all that. It's like a living organism with blood vessels that criss and cross at ganglia, et cetera, and those are the power places that all indigenous people always have gathered all throughout millennia, and that's where temples are, where pyramids are, where civilizations have gathered at these points. And so he said that they would come there knowing it was a power place 56,000 years ago. So then when they decided to create the first creation above ground, it was to be a manifestation of the Great Mother. So that's why she is the guardian. She controls all the energy that comes in. It's even further explained by another great teacher named Drunvalo Melchizedek, who started teaching in the 80s, still teaches today. And he would talk about the Sphinx actually controls all the energy that comes into our planet, and it comes out the other side of the planet, which would be Maui in Hawaii.
So the Sphinx is the mother of humanity?
Yes, of all things.
And there were no male pharaohs?
No. No. What we're looking at is not a monarchy. This is our major difference with Egyptology, which concentrates on kingsless, with pharaohs and their sons, and this one, then this pharaoh, the dad, Ramses had this built. Not of that is true. There are certain individuals, when you really study the subject, like I have for over 50 years, like he had for over 75 years. I mean, he started at the age of 5 and 6. He died at 82. He was 75 years. At the age of 6, he was put out as an archaeologist, clearing rubble for American Egyptologist named George Reisner from Harvard University, who was digging on the Giza Plateau in the 30s, who discovered a lot of things about the Sphinx. Hakim was there as a boy of 6, clearing rubble away. for this man. He would sneak away, slip into a tomb, 6 years old. He'd look up at the ceiling and he'd say, I have to know what's written on the walls. And that's how he started his career. 75 years as a field Egyptologist, as archaeologist. And he was had dual degrees. He was actually academically trained in archaeology and Egyptology. So the idea is that they did things in layers and the priests controlled everything. This is one of our basic teachings. It was not a monarchy. It was a theocracy. Many people today do not even understand what that word means, but we're actually almost tending towards it in this country today. But Iran certainly is a theocracy. Saudi Arabia is a theocracy. So they exist today. It's where the religion and the government are interspersed. There's no separation. So what you have here, and I document it in my second book, which you'll have to read too, and when we can have another interview about that. But there I talk about how religion comes to be, and there is a time when there is these certain individuals. They are not yet called priests, but we call them chanut, is the ancient term. It later becomes the term funerary priest, because in my second book, we talk about how religion was created basically around the fear of death. In the ancient time, when we're talking about over 12,000 years ago, when we lived in this time of total enlightenment, which we called Aten or Iten, there was no idea of death. There was no concept of death. One of Hakim's basic teachings is there was no word in the ancient, we say Kemetian, not Egyptian. Kemet was the name of the civilization, meant the black land. So we call them Kemetians. Their language was Kemetian. There was no word for death. It was said to be westing or west. So in other words, they saw no beginning to consciousness, no end to consciousness. They didn't necessarily believe in a Big Bang theory. Only the Big Bang theory talks about the physical universe. We're talking about things that are unseen, spirit, which is never created, never destroyed. So in Hakim's understanding, there's no beginning, there's no end. Just in cycles after cycles after cycles after cycles. So in the previous cycle, there was no religion. There was no concept of God. When it comes around this last 5,000 plus years, it's based on the idea of death, of what happens in his physical body. So these are the people who became power because they do certain things to keep consciousness high as the senses are waning. We're taught by our teacher, Hakim, that we are innately born with 360 senses. We think we only have five. 180 we label feminine, 180 we label masculine. Those were the gods and goddesses of Egypt. There's 360. Some people say, oh, there's over 800. No, they're just duplicates of these basic 360, which interestingly is the degrees in a circle. So 360 makes full consciousness. That's how they were all different principles of creation. They were never looked on as we do today as God or goddess, as Allah, as Yahweh. No. Osiris, Isis, they were principles of creation, masculine and feminine, all in duality. So these people, they controlled this understanding, and they saw that people were losing the senses, and they were going to understand that there is no death anymore. They were going to start to question what happens in this physical form. So they'd make a decision to make a deal with them. You take care of us, we'll take care of your body. After you drop it, we'll make sure you come back. And you have what Hakim called, they created the second life, the life after this one. And so these individuals make arrangements with those that are what you could call the warrior class, or the ruling families, or the powerful families that have wealth and have accumulated. As things are starting to happen, as things are turning what we call patriarchal, you're getting conflicts for land, you're getting control, you're getting power. So these wealthy families, they make what I call the unholy alliance with these so-called beings who will become the priests. You work for me, I work for you. That has gone on for 5,000 years, and it is what is the system today. That's why even you could talk about communism, socialism, they're supposed to be godless, no religion involved, that's nonsense. Because even socialism, communism, even fascism still have religious overtones. They become the Führer, the dictator, becomes a religious icon, becomes a Jesus symbol. I mean, the Germans looked upon Hitler as we, as Christians, look upon Jesus.
So we're at the end of a cycle right now, and you were talking about the previous cycle, that they had no idea of death.
This would be, we have an interim, I say this cycle fully comes in force around 5,000 years ago. Interestingly enough, that's exactly the date of the Jewish calendar. and other calendars that come across that start up around 5,000 some odd years ago. Even there's an Egyptian calendar, which is almost about, but based on the movement of the star system Sirius, which they started dating around 5,000, 6,000 years ago. So it's around this period. But so I'm saying something that we talk about, and Brian Foster has written an excellent book about that, because he and I are in agreement about that. What really ended a lot of these ancient civilizations, and we can see this, we show the physical evidence at these sites, was a worldwide cataclysm. The basis of the flood myth in our Bible, the basis of all flood mythologies that you can find in about 250 different peoples around the world. So it happened, we say, around 12,000 years ago. So there was a whole bunch of years, thousands of years in between, which Barbara Hanclough, another great author who was a student of my teacher Hakim, wrote. She called it the blank, because there isn't a lot of archaeological evidence of this period. It's like after this great cataclysmic event, which wiped out these civilizations, including Kemet, we can show the massive evidence of Kemet, of a thousand of 100-ton statues and blocks tossed around. And again, Brian does that in Bolivia. People go to Pumapunku, Tiahuanacu. That's one of the great sites in the world that shows evidence of the worldwide cataclysm. You get 6 feet of silt at Tiahuanacu. It was great flood as Lake Titicaca was thrown up in the air, and massive tsunami. And so the evidence is there. So we have thousands of years of where there's forms and forms until around you see the beginning of what we call patriarchy, what we call the age of Amun, the age of this time of darkness. Interestingly enough, it's called Amun or Amun. And what we use in our three patriarchal languages, in Judaism or Amen, in Christianity, Amen, in Islam, Amin. It's saying, "Thy will be done." It's talking to God. You made a prayer and you're ending it with saying, "Thy will be done." But actually, the word comes from the Kemetian word, Amun, Amun, which is the age of darkness, night, of duality. So actually, people, and I'm committing blasphemy for people who are very religious, but I'm sure they're not those people who maybe listen to your show. But to say Amen is to say, "So let it be in darkness, so let it be kept hidden."
So we've been in a cycle of darkness for 5,000 years?
Yes, and we think we're the most enlightened beings. Look at the last 5,000 years. How many hundreds of millions of people have been killed in wars?
Oh, yeah.
Basically over these religions.
And you were saying was the previous cycle, was the culture at its peak?
Yes, that's it. That's how the cycle goes. Let me give you the five stages as you read in Land of Osiris. We'll repeat them for people. It actually is it moves the five daily movements of the sun that corresponds to five levels of consciousness, which deal with the levels, and five ages of our prehistory. So total cycle of 65,000 years. Hakim would tell us that this beginning cycle began 56,000 years, 65,000 years ago, and then the Sphinx, first thing above ground, 54,000. But it's different. It goes back cycle after cycle after cycle, back and back and back. And people who study the Vedas, who study Hindu mythology and understand that they talk about cycles, do we have dates among the Maya, where they talk about calendrical dates going back millions of years and millions of years into the future? So that's why people had it so wrong about December 21st, 2012, thinking it was going to be the end of the world, because the Mayans never said that. It was the end of a major cycle. That's all. Now we're back in another cycle. Because they have dates on some of their temples that go millions of years into the future. So the idea is that we go from the first stage, Cheper, the scarab beetle. That is the dawn. It is called the driller. It is a hermaphrodite, both male and female. It's the beginning of consciousness, birth of consciousness. So it's used as rebirth, symbol of rebirth in Egyptology. They use it as rebirth, but it's actually the dawn, the beginning of consciousness. Second stage is Ra. So people say, "Oh, isn't that the sun god? We say, "No, thanks for playing. That's only one-fifth of the understanding. Ra is the sun at noon, the heat of the sun. It represents the adolescent stage of consciousness. It's also characterized by the ram being stubborn. Why is it stubborn? Well, you know, when we're teenagers, we all remember that, we tend to think we know everything. We don't listen to adults at that age. So that's the adolescent stubborn stage. But then you move on to what's called Un. Now, Un is characterized by a man standing upright. So it's patriarchal by then. Standing upright, holding a cane. It is the wise. We become mature. We become conscious now. The sun in early afternoon. We become wise. But the highest stage is the next stage, which is called Aten or Iten, which is an old man hunched over on a stick, which shows the wiser, which is the highest state of consciousness. Therefore, saying in our understanding, in that time period, we're all using 360 senses. So each to different degrees, of course. There still was an understanding. We weren't robots. We weren't just all the same. We each had a different individuality. This is what it's hard for people to understand. There could be an understanding that there wasn't speciation. There wasn't gender identity. There wasn't male roles. There wasn't female roles. There wasn't black is weaker than white and color. There wasn't race. There wasn't any understanding. There was individuality because you were who you were according to what you capability of. But we each had the ability to use 360 senses. At this time, everybody is to some degree of enlightened. And then we built pyramids. Then we had an incredible civilization. Then we lived hundreds of years, a civilization bathed in infrasound. It is the stuff of mythology. It's the golden age of all the great myths. It exists in the Greeks, the Romans. I mean, everyone you can think of talks about the myth of the great ages, the great ages, the great times. That's what the Lord of the Rings was all about, based on those ancient stories of Celtic mythology. So that was the time. And then you move into Amun. Amun is night. No image originally. That's what was copied in Judaism. Because Judaism copied that straight from the religion of Amun of Egypt, that there's to be no image of God. So everybody said, oh, the Egyptians were idol worshippers. They worshipped all these idols. But Amun originally had no image. Later they did make an image for him. But so that idea was night. Everything is hidden. Everything is duality. Everything is polarity. And that has been the last 5,000 plus years. So there we go. We get knocked off our pedestal right away, because people today, majority of human beings, would tell you that we are the greatest part of evolution of humanity. They think evolution's just gone in a straight line. We've gone from these so-called ape-like, human-like, what did we really descend evolve from apes, or were we alien genetically manipulated, whatever that was, it happened very long, millions of years ago, and we deviated from the apes at least 5 to 10 million of years ago, and we came along just in a straight line. This guy did this, he built this tool, oh, his brain got a little bigger, and then he did this little grass hut, and then he built a little wooden thing, and here we are today with our skyscrapers that won't last 1,000 years like the pyramid has. The pyramid has lasted 25,000 years, and it still stands. We have built nothing today that will last that long. If you've ever seen those shows on National Geographic, or Smithsonian did it also, projecting what the world would be like if there were no humans. 100 years after us, 500 years after us, 1,000 years after, 5,000 years after humans, there's no buildings, there's no evidence of this civilization, hardly at all, because metal rusts, concrete corrodes, granite stays almost forever.
So we are in Amen, or darkness. Yes. In the lowest.
Coming out. The secret to Hakim's teachings, as you saw in Land of Osiris, is he called this time the awakening. It fits in with the Mayan story of the change shifting in 2012. It fits in with all, again, myths of indigenous people all around the planet, that the cycles are coinciding now. This is a time of the time of critical, I mean, even we know it's a critical time for our planet, what we continue to do. So this is what Hakim called the awakening. And he was supremely confident that we were going to survive this.
And how long have you worked with Hakim?
I worked with him the last 16 years of his life. I first heard his name in the late 80s. I got involved with some other research, which may be another interview sometime, about what are called crystal skulls. Skulls that are carved out of quartz crystal. Mm-hmm. Which actually, I started out as an archaeologist and then as a metaphysician. And I worked with two of the greatest teachers in that field, a man named F.R. Nick Nocerino and Dr. Marcel Vogel. And I worked with many crystal skulls. So I was on a panel at San Francisco Whole Life Expo in 1987 with others talking about Crystal Skull book, which had just came out, which I was interviewed for. There was a booth there from a group called Power Places Tours. They were a group based in Southern California at the time that were doing some of the first tours to Egypt in the 80s and doing what they called spiritual metaphysical tours. So I met two people who were working at this booth, two wonderful people, Dr. Ruth, the blessed Dr. Lakewell, she's passed away, and Harry Hover were their names. And they were acting as tour representatives. They worked leading tours for this company. And then I met the director of the company, whose name was Dr. Toby Weiss. And they talked about, and at this time I was very much into the teachings that John Anthony West is the most strongest proponent of, the teachings of Ari Schwalla de Lubitsch, an Alsatian mathematician, philosopher, who was one of the first alternative Egyptologists who questioned in the early part of the 20th century the paradigms of Egyptology, saying there was a previous civilization, a more advanced civilization, and the Sphinx was much older. He was the first one who wrote a book that was translated into English in the 50s, where he intimated that the Sphinx was older because of water erosion. That led John Anthony West on the quest to find Robert Schoch and bring geology into the picture. So Schwaller was one of the greats, and I was into Schwaller in the 80s very strongly. So was this Dr. Toby Weiss. So he said, oh, you're into the spiritual and metaphysical? Yes, I am too. He says, well, then you have to come to Egypt with us, because our particular tour guide we use really knows the old ways. He really knows the traditions. I said, really? And he just mentioned Hakim. All he said was Hakim. Okay, stayed in my mind. Through a series of events, I was basically funding my own research for many years, doing odd jobs here and there. I basically not actually had a career, but this alternative research that I had different jobs to fund doing this. So I didn't have the money to get to Egypt until the early 90s. Things happened. Miraculously, the money appeared. I went to Egypt, went with Power Places Tours, hooked in with a lady named Nikki Scully, who's also very important in this whole story. And sure enough, they were using Hakim as their tour guide. So it will be an anniversary. And this is an important year because before I get off with you, I want to talk about a project I'm currently involved with that's going to be a video biography of him and myself in this field. Because in November this year will be 25 years. 1992 I went, and the first day I'm there, there he is standing in front of the Sphinx. And the key understanding for me is for people to understand, and this is where it goes from more objective to the subjective, but this is what we do. I really basically started this journey when I was about 8 years old myself. My mother, to her blessed memory, I always tell this story, and I will always continue to tell this story. To her blessed memory, she kept around our house the two great pictorial magazines of the day. Now, I'm 71, so I grew up in the late 40s and early 50s. That was Look magazine and Life magazine and National Geographic. I've always been a fan of National Geographic, going back to the early 50s. Well, around 8 years old, I opened up an issue of National Geographic and stopped dead on a picture of the Sphinx and the Great Pyramid. Something stirred deep within my being. At that age, I could not articulate it. I could not understand it. But I know now that the Sphinx made an unconscious connection with me. That's why I speak so strongly of her, as I have. She has been guiding me all my life. She led me through all the journeys of my life, going to sciences, all the things I did, and she led me to Hakim. So here it comes this day, the first day he's standing in front of the Sphinx, and he's talking to us. And he just casually says to us, she, behind me, is 52, 54,000 years old. And I looked at the Sphinx, and she said to me, as she still does talk to me, and people can take that for what it will. The thing is, when I'm at the point in my life, I say these things, and I don't care if people believe it or not, because it is my truth, and it is my reality. So she said to me at this point, this is the man you've been looking for all your life. This is your teacher. He is my son. And that began the journey. So for the last 16 years of his life, I was his closest. I wasn't the only one. There are going to be other famous people that are going to be in this video, like Greg Braden, like Barbara Henclow, and others, maybe Christopher Dunn, other people who have met Hakim along the years who will speak to him. I wasn't the only one, but I was the one he took to be his closest. I was the one who had a background in archaeology and Egyptology that could go the distance with him where he wanted to go. So we went into incredible levels with this teaching, something that he had put together through his life, gathered from all his knowledge of Egyptology. There was not a greater Egyptologist who ever lived, and yet he was not an Egyptologist. He together, I realized very quickly on working with him that there was a system that just wasn't just odd definitions, odd understandings. He had developed a system of understanding with principles, with basic fundamentals to understand a different understanding. And so I put the term on it. He was telling us the civilization was Kempt. As you know, the glyphs, which the Greeks called hieroglyphs, which is called sacred signs, what it means in their language, which Hakim was the only one who called the Suf language, where the word Sufi comes from, the written language of Kemet, they didn't have written signs for vowels. Vowels were sacred. And I knew that through my tradition coming up as a Jew, coming through Judaism, vowels are usually not written in Judaism. They have to be understood. They're written now for modern Jews because they have to be able to pronounce the words correctly. But usually vowels were not written. And the same thing with the Rosicrucian order, which is another tradition I went through. Vowels are chanted to raise your consciousness. So vowels are sacred, have always been sacred. So it's usually written KMT in Kemet. But we put the vowels in there. I spell it Khemit. It's spelled Khemet, Khemet. Anyway, it's Kemet, Kemet. It meant the black land, the dark, rich, alluvial soil, the Nile she deposits every time she floods. And that was the basis of the civilization. So I said, why don't we call it Kemetology? And he loved it. Never become detergent. So I just put the label on it, but it was his system. I added all my years of knowledge, 25 years of Egyptology before I even met him. And it just continues to grow today. But he had a foundation. It's, again, five stages of the sun, what we call the five purrs. Five is a key number, which repeats itself throughout the mythology of these ancient people. So we had a great teacher, Satyan Raja, who's also going to be interviewed for our special, who lives in Canada and has led towards Egypt with me in Medhakim, 2008. So he would talk about the Vedic tradition. Oh, you know, in the Vedas, they talk about four, the yugas, the Kali Yuga, Sat Yuga. And he would say, Hakim would say, you say four, we say five, it's the same thing. It's cycles. Cycles, that's the key basis of our understanding. So with that, we can look at things archaeologically, geologically, see things in terms of cycles, and how civilizations have risen and fallen, risen and fallen, risen and fallen, and we're certainly not the first. And I'm, luckily, I still believe not the last, even though some people do believe we could end all life on this planet. We have the potential to do that for sure. But we're confident that we've been at this brink before, where life is almost, I mean, if you look at this, at least six great geological extinctions that are talked about, life extinctions, biological. And there was one called the pre-Permian extinction, where just about 98% of all life that was on the planet at that time went extinct. So we talk about this event 12,000 years ago, a worldwide cataclysmic event. Many people have written books about it. We're not the only ones. Many people have offered different hypotheses what it is. Dr. Robert Schoch himself believes it was sun, solar impulse, a tremendous amount of activity on the sun. We believe what he's talking about is a byproduct of what is called the Vela supernova. People can Google that too, which occurred between 14,000 and 11,000 years ago, written about by Barbara Hand Clow in a great book she wrote originally called Catastrophobia, which is now reprinted as Awakening the Planetary Mind, based on two authors she published when she was the publisher of Barron Company, called Catastrophe 9500 BC, by two British authors, Allen and Dallaire. Well, they talk about the Vela supernova and how it impacted our entire solar system and probably wiped out maybe 90% of civilization that was on the planet. So we today, speaking to each other, are the ancestors of the only 10% that survived that cataclysm who restarted civilization between 8 to 5,000 years ago. And that's in the archaeological record. We can see it now. We can see when these great civilizations start to arise again. But we're led to believe, if you follow the academic theory, that prior to 12,000 years ago, we're just living in huts, in caves, writing on walls, and you know we couldn't build anything out of stone 12,000 years ago. I can show you things we built out of stone 25,000 years ago, which is the Great Pyramid. We date the pyramid around that date. How we, again, when you go into dating like this, it's only guesstimates. Hakim would say the only solar alignment, so he doesn't agree with those who write about Orion, who write about other connections to the Great Pyramid. The only thing it was aligned to celestially was what was the pole star at that time. And he said the pole star, according to tradition at that time, is what we call Polaris today. It's about to become our pole star again. So he's saying, if you take a precessional age backwards, the Great Pyramid was aligned 26,000 years ago. It was fully functioning machine 15,000 years ago, but they all were. All pyramids were a grid line, and they appear in a grid line around the planet. Other people have written books about this. You know, my book came out that you read 2001. That's 15 years ago, 16 years ago now. Other people have jumped on this subject, show, oh, yeah, there's pyramids on these bands that were all around the same meridian, that the Great Pyramid, there's pyramids all around the planet, and there's even in Antarctica, Bazin, a lot of these are not really planets. Pyramids are natural formations, but it is true. There was a worldwide civilization. It was what mythology says, Atlantis, Lemuria, but it wasn't centered at one place. It was all around the planet, and we see now that they were in contact with each other. That's why we can see similar technologies in ancient Bolivia, in Pumapunku, Tiwanaku, Sure, it has local variation. They use the local stone that they could use. They use certain local techniques, but the same type of what Christopher Dunn calls ancient advanced machining in some of the hardest stones we see ever been on this planet, particularly granitic stones, what you call plutonic stones, which are formed under the earth in magma, which have a lot of crystal in it. That's why the geology uses what's called the Mohs scale, Mohs, 10 being diamond, of course. And so granite has to be dated according to the amount of crystal that's in it, because quartz is at 7. So granite is between 6, 6, 5, 7. And even we see now, because we've had other geologists work with us, that these ancient commissions worked in stone even harder than granite. We believe they used corundum. Now, corundum is right under diamond. That's ruby. That's sapphire. Pure corundum is 9 on the Mohs scale. I can take you to Egypt, and I'm going to be taking my group there. I'm leaving in just a couple, I'm going to be with Brian Foster in Egypt from March 5th through March 19th. March 19th on our tour, and we're going to take people in the museum. And we're going to show you these bowls that are carved out of, many out of granite, many out of diorite, many out of breccia, the hardest stones we know. But there's one that's caught our eye in the last couple of years that we believe has corundum in it, because corundum forms in granitic deposits. So therefore, it wouldn't be pure corundum. It wouldn't be ruby 9, but you're looking at 8, 8.5 on the Mohs scale. And these people only supposedly had copper chisels. Yeah. And they want you to believe that. They'll say it with a straight face. And here I go again. I don't want to be rude to other people, but a certain famous Egyptologist once did a Nova special where he talked about, with a straight face, that they would have 1,000 chisel lined up in a row, 1,000 workers lined up with chisels, as the master mason would be banging into granite with a copper chisel, which cannot dent granite. That would he would And then he would take another one, and there'd be 1,000 chisels in a row, and finally he would make some dent in the granite, which cannot be proven, because copper chisels cannot dent granite whatsoever. We've proved it in demonstration many, many times.
So the oral tradition of Egypt goes back 10,000 years.
It goes back as long as there's been oral tradition, before there was writing. And we date writing earlier than even academia does. Academia dates writing around 6,000 years ago, starting supposedly with the Sumerians. Then all of a sudden, Egyptian hieroglyphs appear out of nowhere. But we date writing back to 6,000 BCE, so that would be 8,000 years ago. But it seems to appear out of nowhere. But before that, how did people communicate? Well, obviously, orally. Obviously, how was histories kept? How was traditions kept? How were rules kept? How were ideas kept? Orally. So that oral tradition is at least 10,000 years, if not longer. Stories have come down, down, down. Supposedly the great myths have come down over generations. But the great flood myth was when, after the cataclysm, and people could just gather around campfires and had to live in grass huts and subsistence living, they would tell stories of the great ancient civilizations. That's where the whole idea of the Golden Ages came from. The great ancestors who were giants and did this. There were giants in the land. That's what the word Nephilim originally means in the Hebrew Bible. It doesn't mean Anunnaki from a planet that sits and thought about in the space.
It doesn't mean giants. It doesn't really mean fallen angels either, then,
No.
does it?
No.
It's just talking about people.
Giants, and we can prove to
Giants.
them. We have, and again, in the Cairo Museum, we're going to take our people and show you, there are 15 feet anthropoid coffins. What do you mean by anthropoid? It means the figure, the visage of the deceased is carved in wood on the outside of the coffin, and they're 15 feet tall.
Isn't
So
that?
Hakim took me there in 1992, 25 years ago, and he looked to look at the coffin. He said, "Stephen, do you think there were bodies inside?" I said, "I don't know. Were there?" And he said, "Yes." I said, "Where are they?" And then he just shrugged his shoulders. They're hidden somewhere. So were they mummies? So they were mummifying then? He showed me a coffin that was made out of platinum, which no Egyptologist talks about. They used to be in the bottom floor of the Cairo Museum. Has been moved. Platinum, not silver, that was pre-dynastic. So they were mummifying way before the dynasties. Again, this idea of religion comes way back in the mists, but it starts 5,000, 6,000, even traces 7,000 years ago, where we're starting to formulate these ideas of what happens to the body, death, and all this, till it finally becomes formalized religion for sure 5,000, 6,000 years ago.
So what does the mainstream say about a 15-foot-tall coffin?
They don't talk about it.
They just don't talk about it.
symbolic. The person was so great that they put a 5-foot mummy in a 15-foot coffin. Yeah. And they believe that. They'll actually tell them that they have the 5-foot mummies that came out of these coffins.
That's so absurd, isn't it?
No, it's not half as absurd as if I'll take you into a place called the Serapeum in Saqqara, where there are boxes, again, stone boxes, out of diorite, granite, granodiorite, that weigh perhaps 70 to 100 tons, that are carved with magnificent precision, which Chris Dunn used in his book, Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt, published in 2010, as a smoking gun. The precision is incredible. It's supposedly carved with copper. They say it is a sarcophagus for bulls.
Yeah, I've heard that.
No bull mummy, no traces of bulls was ever found anywhere in this area.
I've heard that before. That's pretty crazy, too.
Yeah, that's one of the only been open to the public since September of 2012. So it's only been since 2013 we've been taking our tour groups here. And all tour groups can go in there now. So now people are taking pictures and sending them all around the world, where I was in there in 1997. Chris Dunn was in there in the early 2000s with permission from Zaki Hawass. So we knew what was in there. We talked about it, but we were the first because, again, not open to the public until 2012.
So what does your teacher, Hakim, say about these sarcophagus that we were just talking about?
We call them stone boxes. They were for resonance. Now, we don't fully know. The function is still yet to be determined. Like a lot of things, we talk about the Great Pyramid. We said it was an energy device. It's a great machine. But it produced so many different types of energy that we don't even know. We have not even documented all of them, from electricity, electromagnetism, from radio waves, from microwaves. We even have a outstanding, world-renowned theoretical physicist who lives in Ukraine, who believes that the Great Pyramid pulses quantum waves. And he has a device that could be brought to Egypt, battery-operated, that could prove that. It's just a matter of getting the funding to get him over there to do that. So we actually believe that those who built the Great Pyramid had a knowledge of quantum physics we're only approaching today. So we don't know exactly what the function of the boxes were, but the resonance of the boxes seem to be tuned to certain frequencies to amplify the energy of water and sound. So this was a civilization that was using many, many different types of forms of energy. Infrasound, for one, that kept, again, immune systems at optimum operation. We don't believe any virus or bacteria affected people then.
So the people in the last cycle could have been 15-foot tall. And lived hundreds of years.
Yes. Again, if you go to the Old Testament, Methuselah was 935 years.
Yeah.
And again, according to interesting tradition that comes out of Kabbalah, comes out of Jewish mysticism, is that the original architect of the Great Pyramid was Enoch. It's Hanok in Hebrew. Enoch, with Hanuk in the ancient language.
Yes, Hanuk.
He lived 365 days. It's just the number of the solar year. Isn't it interesting? Those kind of numbers. People love to play with the numbers. I'm not the mathematical geek that a lot of people are, but people who get into the Great Pyramid or get into numbers, you can play with numbers, and numbers were sacred. I mean, there was a whole science called Gematria. It's part of Kabbalah. That numbers are all sacred. They all have meaning. And Hakim pointed to us certain numbers which were very important to the ancient commissions. 5, always 5, and the number 42. Because he told us originally Kemet was made up of 42 different tribes. And those tribes were all colors, white, red, black, yellow, and blue. There was a blue race. And then all spread around the planet. But that, and then we see the number 42. There is the 42 judges of Osiris. There's 42 steps which lead up to the Holy Holies. We see again around the temples, 42 was used over and over and over again. So there's a reason that they chose these numbers. It had meaning to them. And so people really get into playing with numbers.
Well, Stephen, we have almost already gone an hour. Boy, that was really quick. I can't believe we went that quickly.
It does.
Your book, The Land of Osiris, I will continue to read. It's just fantastic.
Great.
You also have a new book. And did you?
Not a new book. That was 2005. It's From Light into Darkness. It's the evolution of religion in ancient Egypt. We basically talk how it's I was the one that made this separation because I was tired of the academic explanations of religion as being hardwired, and spirituality is. And so I made a separation between religion and spirituality. Religion, as we know, especially patriarchal religion, is only 5,000 years old.
And you guys are getting ready to do another trip to Egypt?
Yes, it will be the fifth Techno Spiritual Tour, March 5th to 19th. And I will be returning in the fall with a professional film crew to do something that's been my life's project. It's my payback to do a biography of Hakim and Kematology and how it came to be. And I will go to all the sites and show people the things that he showed me that most people never see.
Any closing statement you'd like to make to the listeners?
Just that, again, you brought it up. We would always try to end this on a positive note because Hakim was supremely confident. We are in the time called the awakening. We're coming to the new dawn. Kheper's come back. We've gone through 65,000 years. The Maya's 26,000. All these cycles are coinciding now. So basically he was saying that the message is still positive, even though there's so much negativity and it's so dark in the world today, that we will come through. A lot of people are going to move to the other side, but that humanity is not going to end. Life on the planet is not going to end.
Well, Stephen, it's been a real pleasure speaking with you, sir.
Same, sir, here, Mark.
I hope we talk again soon.
I would like that, and when I come back from Egypt, I'll be open to that.
Okay, that's great.